Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, moms and dads, listen up. Many of you are ruining your children, and you are ruining America. Seriously. I'm not actually trying to have a Colbert Report moment here. Just listen to our next guest. She's Julie Lithcott-Hames, former dean of freshmen at Stanford University and author of the new book, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. And she joins us now from Stanford, California. Julie Lithcott-Hames, welcome to Radio Boston.
Meghna, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Okay, so we are talking to you on a day and a week where here in Boston, literally thousands of college students are coming back into town or coming into town for the first time. I mean, the streets are beginning to get lined up with moving trucks. And in those trucks are jumping out lots of parents as well. So it's a great time to talk to you about this. I'm just wondering, what is it that you saw in your years as dean of freshmen at Stanford that helped you to inspire or helped inspire you to write this book?
Wow. Well, let me start by saying I'm also a parent. I'm a little behind those parents who are showing up in Boston right now, in that my own kids are only 14 and 16. But I can see that moment coming in my own sons and daughters' lives, and I'm excited for it. You know, here on the Stanford campus for 10 years as dean, basically, what I was seeing over the 10 years were more and more parents coming and wanting to be involved well beyond move-in day, and really doing the thinking for their students, the choice-making, the problem-solving, the advocating, doing for their students what, you know, quite frankly, someone your age and my age when we were 18 could handle for themselves.
Such as? And more specifically?
Well, absolutely. You know, the parents wanted to know, what are the research opportunities here in science? We'd like to know more about that. Or, you know, my son or daughter is planning to travel overseas for a quarter. You know, can we have an orientation session so that we're really prepared for our sons or daughters' overseas experience?
So the parents wanted to be given orientation for their students going abroad.
Yeah.
Wow.
Or
okay.
We're not happy with the grade and we'd like to talk to the professor.
Uh-huh. Okay, and so you were dean of freshmen and undergraduate advising as a whole for 10 years, you said. I mean, what did this happen at the beginning of your 10 years? Did you see it over time?
You know, I was on the campus starting in 98 in different roles, and that's really when my colleagues working with undergraduates began seeing parents who were showing up and not leaving, you know, wanting to be somehow involved in the day-to-day lives of their sons or daughters. They were small in number, and they made everyone giggle because their behavior was so unusual and atypical. But over the years, we stopped laughing and really started questioning, what does this mean for the life of the university that, as your prior guest and you so beautifully just discussed, you know, is really meant to open students' minds to a universe of ideas? You know, what does this mean if there's a set of third parties, however well-meaning, parents who really expect to play a role in the life of the university? I guess what I'm saying is, you know, in the early days of my tenure as dean, they were small in number, but every year they grew in number. And every year my students seemed more and more accomplished in a resume and transcript sense, but less and less familiar with their own selves and less accustomed to planning and making their own way. And particularly as my colleague Adina Glickman would say, as she coined the term with her colleague Abigail Lipson at Harvard, Abigail and Adina decided that students these days were quote-unquote failure deprived. They had achieved so much, but their path had been smoothed, and parents had assiduously avoided any fallback or failure. So they arrive at university, you know, having made it, but really ill-equipped to cope when life or college or young adulthood would throw a curveball their way. And then,
right,
of course, they felt they were the anomaly who somehow, you know, had failed, and they weren't equipped to cope with that.
Yeah.
So we really reached a crisis.
I mean, this is a big issue right now in the world of parenting. I mean, you're not the first person to write about it, but it's your perspective as having been an administrator at a major university, which I find so interesting. But you also mentioned that you're a parent yourself, and you know, listeners will know that, of course, I am too. So I've got particular maybe personal motivation to want to get as much information from you as possible. But when you went home at the end of the day from the Stanford campus to home, you know, your home in Silicon Valley, did you suddenly look around and say, oh, my gosh, I'm doing the same things?
Magna, I'm going to admit it to you and to all of your wonderful listeners, as I have also admitted it to audiences as I go and talk about it. And in my book, yes, I had my own very humbling aha moment in 2009. I had just the night before been telling a set of new parents of Stanford freshmen to please trust the kid, trust the university, and now leave, go home. And, you know, what is wrong with these people? Why can't they let go and trust their son or daughter? Has the skills is what was running through my mind the night before. And then here I am the next night leaning over and cutting my own kid's meat at age 8 and 10. I was cutting my 10-year-old's meat. And all of a sudden it clicked. You know, they don't magically become competent at age 18 or the night before they are freshmen in college. You know, childhood is meant to create those competencies. We are meant to instruct our children in the how-to-dos of life, you know, not just cultivate their every academic and extracurricular moment. So I was very humbled to discover not only was I cutting their meat, but they weren't doing really any chores around the house. They were not making, they weren't developing a skill set, a mindset, a set of habits they were going to need when I launched them out into, you know, the world of college one day. And that's when I got the connection between what I was seeing on my campus and what was happening in childhood itself.
Suddenly I find myself quietly reevaluating everything that I do with my wonderful offspring. Okay, well, that's for a later time. Listeners, we're talking with Julie Lithcott-Hames. She's former Dean of Freshman and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford University. She's author of the new book, How to Raise an Adult: Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. She's joining us today from Stanford, California. And I'm just wondering, if you're listening, do you feel like you're guilty of falling into the overparenting trap? What do you make of Julie Lithcott-Hames' message? Do you see evidence of a lack of life skills in the young people around you, or maybe even in your own kids? And are you ready to change your own parenting habits? Or perhaps do you have a defense of overparenting that maybe it's essential in a highly competitive, fast-paced, globalized world? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Okay, so Julie, I'm curious. You list a bunch of reasons for why we may find ourselves in this overparenting trap. Everything from, you know, the terror of stranger danger to maybe overusing the term bullies. You also interestingly sort of take aside play dates as a potential reason why we're so much too much in our kids' lives. Play dates, why?
Well, play is the work that children do, according to the gurus of play in our country, a man named Peter Gray right there in the Boston area at Boston College. Howard Chudikoff would say the same thing. Play is the work that children do. But starting in the early 80s, parents began putting play in the calendar and instead of letting it happen freely and then observing it, hovering over it, just telling kids how to play, what to play with, and intervening when they weren't quite getting along, sharing toys. We've really, you know, it was with the best of intentions that we managed to really take the play out of play. As a result, you know, kids are used to being in an environment where, you know, they'll be told what to do and they're expected to have fun doing it. And an adult will sort of sort things out if there's trouble. That's just absolutely the opposite of what play is meant, you know, to do for a child, which is, you know, to teach them to use their creativity and their imagination to invent stuff, you know, to learn the various ways in which you negotiate with other kids, to work out the problems you're experiencing in your life. So it's really a classic example of, you know, how with the best of intentions, we've managed to really mess up, you know, a foundational element of childhood.
Well, this is really important because I think that everything in your book that you point out is possible reasons for all this overparenting. You know, it's undergirded, as you just said, with no one's doing this on purpose to ruin their children, right?
Nobody wants to ruin their children.
Misshapen 18-year-olds can't make a decision. It's all
it's
with
the
best of intentions, right? I mean,
right.
that's the real irony here.
Well, it's more than the best of intentions. Look, we're motivated by this tremendous, fierce love and this tremendous, fierce instinct that says, ensure that your child is successful out there. We've just gotten misguided about what that means. We think we'll always be there to protect and direct and hold their hands, and we won't. We will die, and one day they will be without us. And we've got to know with tremendous certainty that when that horrible day comes, that they've got what it takes. And this is where it gets big picture and apocalyptic, and people say, really? Is this really an issue? And the answer is yes. Studies from the field of psychology are saying overhelped kids end up with greater anxiety and depression. Why? Because when we overhelp, we deprive them of the chance to forge their own sense of competency, capacity, capability. That's only going to develop when they do the doing and the thinking and the problem solving in their own lives. So it seems paradoxical, but we actually have to back off so that they can step forward and lead their own lives.
But how pervasive is this?
Is it really?
I mean, or is it just sort of the hashtag middle class / affluent problem?
Oh, well, absolutely. It's hashtag middle and upper middle class. And, you know, going back to your prior interview, you know, there's a tremendous, you know, set of different difficulties associated with growing up poor and working class. And those matter very much as well. Look, this is a problem. The problem I'm talking about emerges out of the affluence and influence that parents in the middle class and above have. They've got the time and money such that they can take off work and go to that soccer game and always be on the sidelines. And, you know, they're educated enough perhaps that they can really overhelp with their kids' homework. And they're pretty certain that if they just force their kids down a STEM field, you know, to that particular college, their kid will be successful. So there's an arrogance that comes, you know, a sense of we can and should control every outcome. And, you know, again, best of intentions, but it's led to, you know, now almost a generation of, you know, adolescents and young adults who might look really impressive in terms of the scores and grades they've got, but who are rather existentially impotent, as I put it. Mm. They don't have enough of a sense of self such that they are self-motivated and, most importantly, can really bounce back from what life will do to them. And that's what we need if they're going to lead our government and our schools and our nonprofits and our nation and our families in the coming decade.
Well, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. We're talking with Julie Lithcott-Hames. She's author of How to Raise an Adult. Let's go to Paul, who's calling from Westford. You're on the air, Paul.
Hi, Magna. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a teacher. I teach middle school science. And what I've seen over the last 5 to 10 years is what I'm described as snowplow parents. And your speaker mentioned the same sort of thing, clearing the way of all obstacles. And I just wanted to say that it's a huge concern for me. I'm a new parent, relatively new parent. I have a 2-year-old and a newborn, and I'm worried about them. I don't want to be that way. I hope I'm not going to be that way. And I just, how do we get the message, really, to the parents? That's my concern. How do we get the message to the parents?
Paul, thank you so much for your call. Julie?
Paul, thanks for being on the front lines as a middle school teacher. Such an important role. And I hear this from teachers all over. This is what they're seeing. And it often ends up driving teachers out of this critical profession. Here's what I would say. And it's funny because my own kids back to school night is tonight. And I've got an opportunity to go and be that parent who raises her hand in the classroom at back to school night and says, teacher, can you tell me what your policy is about parental involvement in homework? And I know that for the most part, I'm sending a teacher a softball because teachers like you are desperate to say, parents, back off. You are not a 4th grader. You are not an 8th grader. You're not a 10th grader. You've done that. Let your child be that person. Trust that us, you know, we here in the teaching profession have what it takes to teach your child. So teachers need a tremendous amount of support from parents, but I think at a district level or certainly a school level, if schools could start having the confidence to stand up to well-heeled parents in particular and articulate policies such as do not do your child's homework. If we see evidence of it, we'll penalize the grade.
Yeah.
You know, do not bring your kids forgotten lunch or backpack because they need to learn the quote-unquote hard way.
Let them starve, Julie Lithcott-Hames. Come
on
now.
They're not going to starve, Magna. It'll happen once and then the kid, guess what, learns a lesson. I need to remember my lunch. The only thing they learn if we bring it day after day is that mom or dad will always be there for me, which is not true.
So it's interesting because in the book, you have a chapter titled Being There for Them. At the very top of it, you actually quote Dr. Tim Walden, who's a superintendent of a, as you identify it, small suburban school district in Massachusetts. And he says that he's been a school administrator since 1998. And back in 98, most of the time when he would have to call a parent with some news of misbehavior of their child, the parent would respond with, that's bad. We want to work with the school to make this right. But nowadays, when he calls home, he hears parents go through the process of questioning the authority and judgment of the administrator. And why are you doing this? Surely you're in the wrong, teacher.
Yeah. So we've gotten so afraid that unless our child's childhood is error-free, flawless, and perfect, they won't succeed in life. And so we'd rather take their side when they're accused of wrongdoing, or correct their math homework, or rewrite that essay so that they achieve some short-term win. You know, we do that out of love and fear, but the long-term point is they don't learn the lessons, and then they end up as adults who've always been bailed out of a situation, haven't learned to be accountable for their own actions or responsible for their own decisions or their own stuff.
Well, let's take another call. Dorian is calling from Swampscott. You're on the air, Dorian.
Hi. I just wanted to make a point that I have a daughter who was born premature, which engenders that feeling of protectiveness in both myself and my husband. And recently, my daughter has been attending a very cocoon-like private school to manage her issues that had come from being a preemie, but then also we sort of continued that protectiveness. And she herself spoke up and asked us to take her out of the private school and allow her to go to public school for her middle school 7th grade so that she could meet new people, try new things, and be allowed to do things for herself. And she said, actually, in quotes, I might not do perfectly and I might have some problems, but I think with some time I'll get used to it and I think I'll end up doing okay. So I think there's this natural desire in some children that we parents really need to be attending to that allows them to experience some things for themselves and learn from those experiences.
Dorian, I think you make such an excellent point. Thank you for your call. Julie Lithcott-Hames, your response to that?
Dorian, what a beautiful statement. I wish we could have your daughter on video, because there's nothing more compelling than a child saying, please let me do this. Please trust that I can. Please let me try. I might fall, you know, I might fall back a little bit, but please trust that I can recover from that. There's no stronger voice on this subject than that of the kids. And I have to say, going around the country, as I'm starting to do, when I hear from young people themselves, those are the moments that just, you know, when the emotion surges up in me, because they're crying out for greater independence and freedom. Humans hunger, you know, to work hard and to develop mastery of things. They don't want to be held back by somebody's overprotection. Your daughter couldn't have put it more beautifully. Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, let's take one more call here. Pranit is calling from Medford. You're on the air, Pranit.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually a sophomore going to UMass Amherst next year. And I just want to give my perspective and kind of almost validate. I don't really think the caller needs to be validated.
So what are you seeing? What are you seeing as a sophomore, Pranit?
I'm seeing a lot of kids that when they get to college, their parents have signed them up for all these volunteer activities, and they're not even volunteering. Like, they just signed them up because, hey, it looks good on the college app. And any major decision that they're made, either in schooling or even when applying to colleges, because the parents will be like, oh, you need to apply to this school. And then I talk to my friend. He's like, oh, yeah, I don't even want to go to this school, but my parents told me to do it, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
So when it comes to either making a career choice in college or making a major, like picking a major, they have no idea what to do because they have like a crisis. I've seen this with a lot of people around me because they're like, oh, because they've never been put in that situation where they even need to make such a critical life decision and know the consequences.
On their own. Exactly. Pranit, thank you so much for your call. I mean, Julie Lithcott-Hames, this brings me to a portion of your book, which we really should spend a couple of minutes on, and that is, what is it that you think an 18-year-old should, you know, be able to do upon, you know, reaching 18? You've got basically a checklist, a different kind of life checklist, you call it.
I do. First of all, I got to say, Pranit, thank you for that call. His voice is stronger than mine on this. He's on the front lines. He's of the age where this is happening, and he sees it around him. Folks, listen to him. It's happening on every campus, okay? Kids manufactured to be a certain something that a college seems to want, but whether they did it volitionally is really an open question. The checklist that your 18-year-old needs, look, they've got to be able to talk to strangers. Their life is going to be full of strangers. They need to know how to make eye contact, be respectful, and advocate for themselves, because they're going to need help and they're going to need it from strangers. They're going to need to know how to contribute to, you know, the well-running of a dorm or an apartment, you know, so they've got to know how to do the laundry and take out the trash and do the dishes. You know, this doesn't sound exciting or sexy. You You know, it's not as glittering and glowy as a high SAT score, but it's the stuff of life. Look, let me tell you something. There's something called the Harvard Grant Study, the longest longitudinal study of humans ever conducted, as far as I know. They studied men, you know, who graduated, you know, 7 or 8 decades ago through their entire life up until their death. Some of them are still alive. And two of the major findings from that study are professional success in life comes from, you know, not having gone to Harvard or Stanford, but from doing chores as a kid. And the sooner you start, the better. And that happiness in life comes from love, from your primary relationship with a partner or spouse, but also from your friendships and relationships with, you know, your family. So it all boils down to, you know, get your kids to do chores and love them and teach them how to love and be capable of love. You know, the rest is window dressing. Mm-hmm. Chores and love. Doesn't matter what school they go to or what career they have. If you want them to be professionally successful or happy, it comes down to, you know, chores and love.
Chores and love. I want to like put that on a big poster and stick it on my door so I see it every day when I leave home. Chores and love. Let's take another call here. Anna is calling from Leominster. You're on the air, Anna.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well, very well. What's your thought today?
My question is, my daughter went to college and the first semester she did very poorly, extremely poorly. And with your guest, I'm just wondering, like now I've become like a pirate mom, like watching everything. So should I sit back and watch it and let her overcome it, or what should I do? Because now I'm kind of confused not to follow up on my daughter.
Yeah.
Thanks for the question, Anna. And the first thing I want you to know is I became a dean of freshmen because I had a terrible start to my freshman year as a college student. I did really poorly and was embarrassed and ashamed. And it was the people on my campus who, you know, could tell me how to do better time management and teach me stronger study skills that, you know, I'll never forget. They supported me and I wanted to do that for a new set of freshmen. So, of course, you're concerned. And of course, your daughter is probably concerned as well. What you want to do is say, honey, you know, let's try to figure out what went wrong. There's academic advising on her campus. There are people there who are paid to care about her progress through college. You know, send her in the direction of those people. Encourage her that she's not the only one who struggles. Many, many freshmen struggle academically or with the social transition. You know, we've got to help them understand there's nothing wrong with you. You know, college is more challenging. That's okay. Go get the support and the resources you need. Reassure her that you still love her, that you believe in her, and that you know she has what it takes, you know, to kind of turn things around.
So, Julie Lithcott-Hames, we've just got about a minute and a half here to go. There's one last sort of area that I wanted to talk with you about, and we touched on it earlier, but in the book you write very clearly, it's not about your own ego parenting. And, you know, there's no we, right? You say, like, we are not going to kindergarten. We are not going to first grade. We are not joining Little League. It's your child who's doing it. And the flip side of that is you point out in the book that parents don't often enough share their own failures with their kids. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, our kids look at us, they admire us, you know, they look up to us. They don't know the extent to which our own path has had twists and turns, you know, and setbacks. And so, you know, what we've got to do as we've got to walk the walk around struggle, you know, not just talk the talk. We've got to say, look, here's where things went wrong for me and here's how I handled it and what I ended up learning from it. We've got to teach them by example that life is not lived according to this, you know, perfect straight line upwards towards success, that, you know, that we too have struggled. Our own egos are very much wrapped up in our child rearing. It's almost as if, you know, our child's accomplishments and grades are metrics of our own worth and value as humans. You know, to put it frankly, we've got to get our own lives back. You know, where our kid goes to college should be a measure of what's right for them, fit and belonging, you know, between them and a school. We got to get our own egos out of it. Our kids and we will breathe a very deep sigh of relief when we do.
Julie Lithcott-Hames, she is former Dean of Freshmen and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford University and author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Such a pleasure to speak with you, Julie. Thank you so much for joining us.
As always, Magna, such a pleasure. Thank you.
And listeners, let us know what you think. Are you guilty of the overparenting trap? And how do you think we can work ourselves out of it? Let us know at radioboston.org. There's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.